thirst for bourbon. He had this aura because he'd actually been to Chicago, and he'd seen Muddy and Little Walter, so he came back with a halo around him. Cyril didn't like anybody. He didn't like us, because he felt the winds of change coming, and he didn't want it. He died very soon afterwards in 1964. But he'd already broken away from Alexis's band to form the R&B All-Stars, also with Charlie Watts on drums, who had a weekly gig at the Marquee in 62, when we first played there. The Ealing Club was a trad jazz club that they took over one night a week. It was a funky room, sometimes ankle-deep in condensation. It was under Ealing Tube Station, and the roof over the stage was one of those thick glass cobbled pavements. So there's all these people walking over your head, and every now and again, Alexis would say, "You want to come up and play?" And you're playing an electric guitar, and you're ankle-deep in water, and you're just hoping everything's grounded right. Otherwise, sparks will fly. My equipment was always on a knife edge. When I got round to wire strings, they were expensive. If one broke, you'd keep another one, and then loop them together and extend it, and put it back on, and it would work. If the string could at least cover the fretboard, you knotted it just above the nut, and then extended it to cover the tuning pegs. It did affect tuning to a certain extent. Half a string here and half a string there. Thank God for scouting and knotting. I had a thing called a de-armand pickup, and it was unique. You could clamp it above the soundboard, and it slid up and down on a spindle. You didn't have a bass pickup or a treble pickup. If you wanted a softer sound, you slid the fucker up the spindle towards the neck, and so you got a bassier sound up there. And if you wanted treble, you slid it down the pole again. And of course this played havoc with its wiring. I used to carry a soldering kit for emergencies, because you'd be sliding this thing up and down, and it was just so breakable. I was always soldering and rewiring behind the amp. A little giant amp, the size of a radio. I was one of the first to get an amp. We were all using tape recorders before that. Dick Taylor used to plug into his sister's Bush record player. My first amp was a radio. I just took that apart. My mother was pissed off. "The radio's not working because I've got it apart, and I'm plugging zzzz, just trying to get a sound." In that respect, good training for later on, honing your sound, matching guitars to amps. We started from scratch with the tubes and valves. Sometimes, if you take one valve out, you can get this really raunchy, dirty sound because you're pushing the machine, and it's got to work overtime. If you put the double A valve back in, then you've got this sweeter sound. That's how I got electrocuted so many times. I kept forgetting to unplug the fucker before I started poking around in the back. We first met Brian Jones at the Ealing Jazz Club. He was calling himself Elmo Lewis. He wanted to be Elmore James at the time. "You'll have to get a tan and put on a few inches, boy." But slide guitar was a real novelty in England, and Brian played it that night. He played "Dust My Broom," and it was electrifying. He played it beautifully. We were very impressed with Brian. I think Mick was the first one to go up and talk to him, and discovered that he had his own band, most of whom deserted him in the next few weeks. Mick and I had come up together to the club and done Chuck Berry numbers, which annoyed Cyril Davies, who thought it was rock and roll, and he couldn't play it anyway. When you start to play in public, and you're playing with some guys that have done it before, you're low in the hierarchy, and you always feel you're being tested. You gotta be there on time, your equipment's gotta be working, which it rarely was in my case. You have to measure up. Suddenly, you're in with the big boys. You're not just pissing around in school gyms. Shit, this is pro. At least semi-pro. Pro with no money. I left art school around this time. At the end, your teacher says, "Well, I think this is pretty good." And they send you off to J. Walter Thompson, and you have an appointment. And by then, in a way, you know it's coming. Three or four real smarty pants with the usual bow ties. "Keith, is it? Nice to see you. Show us what you've got." And you lay the folder out. "I say, we've had a good look at this, Keith, and it does show some promise. By the way, do you make a good cup of tea?" I said yes, but not for you. I walked downstairs with my folio. It was green, I remember. And I dumped it in the garbage can when I got downstairs. That was my final attempt to join society on their terms. The second pink slip. I didn't have the patience or the facility to be a hack in an advertising agency. I was going to end up the T-boy. I wasn't very nice to them in the interview. Basically, I wanted an excuse to be thrown out on my own and thrown back on music. I think, okay, I've got 2 free years, not in the army. I'm going to be a blues man. I went to the Bricklayer's Arms, a seedy pub in Soho, for the first time, for the first rehearsal, for what turned out to be the Stones. I think it was May of 62. Lovely summer evening. Just off Wardour Street, Strip Alley. I get there. I've got my guitar with me. And as I get there, the pub's just opened. Typical brassy blonde old barmaid. Not many customers. Stale beer. She sees the guitar and says, "Upstairs." And I can hear this boogie-woogie piano. This unbelievable Mead Lux Lewis and Albert Ammon stuff. I'm suddenly transported in a way. I feel like a musician, and I haven't even got there. I could have been in the middle of Chicago, in the middle of Mississippi. I've got to go up there and meet this man who's playing this. And I've got to play with him. And if I don't measure up, it's over. That was really my feeling as I walked up those stairs. Creak, creak, creak. In a way, I walk up those stairs and come down a different person. Ian Stewart was the only one in the room, with this horsehair sofa that was split, horsehairs hanging out. He's got on a pair of Tyrolean leather shorts, he's playing an upright piano, and he's got his back to me because he's looking out the window where he's got his bike chained to a meter, making sure it's not nicked. At the same time, he's watching all the strippers going from one club to another with their little round hat boxes and wigs on. Phew, look at that. All the while, this Leroy Carr stuff is rumbling off his fingers. And I walk in with this brown plastic guitar case and just stand there. It was like meeting the headmaster. All I could hope for was that my amp would work. Stu had gone down to the Ealing Club because he'd seen an ad Brian Jones had placed in Jazz News in the spring of 62 for players wanting to start an R&B band. Brian and Stu started rehearsing with a bunch of different musicians. Everybody would chip in $2 for an upstairs room in a pub. He'd seen Mick and me at the Ealing Club doing a couple of numbers and invited us along. In fact, to give Mick his due, Stu remembered that Mick had been coming already to his rehearsals, and Mick said, "I'm not doing it if Keith's not doing it." "Oh, you made it, did you?" And I started with him, and he says, "You're not going to play that rock and roll shit, are you?" Stu had massive reservations, and he was suspicious of rock and roll. I'm, "Yeah." And then I start to play some Chuck Berry, and he's, "Oh, you know Johnny Johnson?" Who was Chuck's piano player. And we started to sling the hash, boogie woogie. That's all we did. And then the other guys slowly started to turn up. It wasn't just Mick and Brian. Jeff Bradford, a lovely slide blues guitar player he used to play with Cyril Davies. Brian Knight, a blues fan, and his big number was "Walk On, Walk On." He had that down, and that was it. So Stu could have played with all these other cats. And actually, we were third in line for this setup. Mick and I were brought in as maybes, tryouts. These cats were playing clubs with Alexis Corner. They knew shit. We were brand new in town, in those terms. And I realized that Stu had to make up his mind whether he was going to go for these real traditional folk blues players. Because by then, I'd played some hot boogie-woogie and some Chuck Berry. My equipment had worked. And by the end of the evening, I knew there was a band in the making. Nothing was said. But I knew that I'd got Stu's attention. Jeff Bradford and Brian Knight were a very successful blues band after the Stones, Blues by Six. But they were basically traditional players who had no intention of playing anything else except what they knew. Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Big Bill Brunsey. Stu, I think, that day realized by the time I'd sung him Sweet Little 16 and Little Queenie, and he'd got behind me, that somehow a deal had been made without anything being said. We just hit a chord together. So I'll be back then, right? See you next Thursday. Ian Stewart. I'm still working for him. To me, the Rolling Stones is his band. Without his knowledge and organization, without the leap he made from where he was coming from, to take a chance on playing with this bunch of kids, we'd be nowhere. I don't know what the attraction was with Stu and me, but he was absolutely the main impetus behind what happened next. Stu, to me, was a much older man, actually only by about 3 or 4 years. But at that time, so it seemed. And he knew people. I knew nothing. I'd just come from the sticks. I think he'd started to enjoy hanging around with us. He just felt there was some energy there. So somehow, these blues players fell away, and it was Brian, Mick, Stu and me, and Dick Taylor on bass. At first, that was the skeleton, and we were looking for a drummer. We said, God, we'd love that Charlie Watts if we could afford him, because we all thought Charlie Watts was a God-given drummer. And Stu put the feelers out. And Charlie said, I'd love any gigs I can get, but I need money to hump these drums on the tube. He said, if you can come back to me and say you've got a couple of solid gigs a week, I'm in. Stu was solid, formidable looking, with a huge protruding jaw, though he was a good-looking guy. I'm sure much of his character was influenced by his looks and people's reaction to them from when he was a kid. He was detached, very dry, down to earth, and full of incongruous phrases. Driving at speed, for example, would be going at a vast rate of knots. His natural authority over us, which never changed, was expressed as, come on, angel drawers, my little three-chord wonders, or my little shower of shit. He hated some of the rock and roll stuff I played. He hated Jerry Lee Lewis for years. Oh, it's all just histrionics. Eventually, he softened on Jerry. He had to crumble and admit that Jerry Lee had one of the best left hands he'd ever heard. Flamboyance and showmanship were not in Stu's bag. He played in clubs. He's got nothing to do with showing off. By day, Ian worked in a suit and tie at Imperial Chemical Industries near Victoria Embankment. And this is what helped him to fund our rehearsal room fees later on. He put his money where his mouth was, at least where his heart was, because he didn't talk a lot about it. The only fantasy Stu ever had was his insistence that he was the rightful heir to Pittenweem, which is a fishing village across the river from St. Andrew's Golf Course. He always felt cheated, usurped through some weird Scottish lineage. You can't argue with a guy like that. Why wasn't the piano loud enough? Look, you're talking to the Laird of Pittenweem. In other words, this is not worth discussing, you know? I once said, what's the tartan then of the Stewart clan? He said, ooh, black and white check with various colors. Stu was very dry. He saw the funny side of things. And it was Stu who had to pick up all the crap after the mayhem. There were loads of guys that were technically 10 times better. But with his feel on the left hand, they could never get to where he was. He might have been the Laird of Pittenweem, but his left hand came out of the Congo. By this time, Brian's got 2 babies with 2 different women, and he's living in London with his latest, Pat, and the kid, having finally left Cheltenham with shotguns firing at his heels. They were living in this damp basement in Powis Square with fungus growing up the wall. And that's where I first heard Robert Johnson and came under Brian's tutorship and delved back into the blues with him. I was astounded at what I heard. It took guitar playing, songwriting, delivery to a totally different height. And at the same time, it confused us because it wasn't band music. It was one guy. So how can we do this? And we realized that the guys we were playing, like Muddy Waters, had also grown up with Robert Johnson and had translated it into a band format. In other words, it was just a progression. Robert Johnson was like an orchestra all by himself. Some of his best stuff is almost Bach-like in construction. Unfortunately, he screwed up with the chicks and had a short life, but a brilliant burst of inspiration. He gave you a platform to work on, no doubt as he did to Muddy and the other guys we were listening to. What I found out about the blues and music, tracing things back, was that nothing came from itself. As great as it is, this is not one stroke of genius. This cat was listening to somebody, and it's his variation on the theme. And so you suddenly realize that everybody's connected here. This is not just that he's fantastic and the rest are crap. They're all interconnected. And the further you went back into music and time and with the blues, you go back to the 20s, because you're basically going through recorded music. You think, thank God for recording. It's the best thing that's happened to us since writing. But real life sometimes entered our domain. And in this case, Mick had come back drunk one night to visit Brian, found he wasn't there, and screwed his old lady. This caused a seismic tremble, upset Brian very badly, and resulted in Pat leaving him. Brian also got thrown out of his flat. Mick felt a little responsible, so he found a flat in a dismal bungalow in Beckenham, in a suburban street, and we all went to live there. It was there I went in 1962 when I left home. It was a gradual departure, a night here and there, then a week, then forever. There was no final moment of parting, of shutting the wicker gate behind me. Doris had this to say on the subject. Doris. From 18 till he left home at 20, Keith was in between jobs. Nothing. That's why his dad got on at him. Get your hair cut and get yourself a job. I waited till Keith left before I moved out. I wouldn't go while he was at home. I couldn't leave him, could I? Break his heart. Then, on the day I moved out, Bert went to work. Keith wasn't with me. I had an electric light bill in my hand, and I went out, and I posted the electric light bill back in, so Bert could pay it. Nice gesture, wasn't it? Bill bought a ground floor flat, because I told him I had to get out. They were just finishing these new flats, and he went up, done a deal with the builders, and we moved in. Bill had some money. Bought it straight out. First telephone I ever had was when Bill bought that flat. I phoned Keith up one night. He said, yes? I said, Keith, we've moved into this flat. I said, I've got a phone. Isn't it lovely? He wasn't that pleased. It was here in Beckenham that we began mysteriously to collect this little core collection of early fans, including Halima Mohammed, my first love. Recently, someone sold back to me a diary I kept in 1963. I think the only diary I ever wrote. More like a logbook of the Stones' progress in those dire days. I must have left it in one of the flats we were always vacating. And whoever it was, held on to it for all that time. In its back pocket was a tiny picture of Lee, as I called her. She was a beauty, with a slightly Indian look about her. It was the eyes that always got me, and her smile. And they're both in the picture, as I remember her. She was at least 2 or 3 years younger than me, 15 or at the most 16, and she had an English mother. I never saw her father, but I remember meeting the rest of her family. I remember going to pick her up and just saying hello to them in Holborn. I was in love with Lee. Our relationship was touchingly innocent. Maybe partly because if we ever got close, we'd have to bunk up in a room full of other people, like Mick or Brian. And she was very young and lived with her parents in Holborn, an only child like me. She must have put up with a lot, however fond she was of me. And it's clear that we had one breakup and then got together again. Second time around, says the diary, bitterly. She was one of a gang of girls who used to come around in 1962. Where they came from, we never figured out. Though my diary shows that we met at least once, at the Ken Collier Club. There wasn't a fan club in those days. This was the pre-fan club period. I don't even know if we had any gigs. We just used to sit around and practice and learn, and somehow we got invaded by a bunch of 5 or 6 Cockney girls from Holborn and Bermondsey. They used to speak great Cockney backslang. They were really young, but they took it on themselves to take care of us. They used to come around and do our washing and cooking, and then stay overnight and do the rest. It was really no big deal. Sex then was mostly just like, it's a bit chilly, let's cuddle. The gas has gone out and no shillings left. I was in love with Lee for a long time. She was just incredibly nice to me. It wasn't a big sexual thing. We just sort of grew into each other. Maybe we were a little pissed one night, and also that shit builds up. Whenever we saw each other, we kept looking at each other, and you know there's something between you. It's whether, can you get across the gap? And eventually, it usually happens. And according to the diary, she came back a second time. She must have been around for our first gig as the Rolling Stones, a band name Stu highly disapproved of. Brian, after figuring out how much it would cost, called up Jazz News, which was a kind of who's playing where rag, and said, we've got a gig at, what do you call yourselves? We stared at one another. It? Then thing? This call is costing. Muddy Waters to the rescue. First track on the Best of Muddy Waters is Rolling Stone. The cover's on the floor. Desperate, Brian, Mick, and I take the dive. The Rolling Stones. Phew. That saved sixpence. A gig. Alexis Corner's band was booked to do a BBC live broadcast on July 12, 1962, and he'd asked us if we'd fill in for him at the Marquee. The drummer that night was Mick Avery, not Tony Chapman, as history has mysteriously handed it down, and Dick Taylor on the bass. The Core Stones, Mick, Brian, and I, played our set list. Dust My Broom, Baby What's Wrong, Doing the Crawdaddy, Confessing the Blues, got my mojo working. You're sitting with some guys, and you're playing, and you go, ooh, yeah. That feeling is worth more than anything. There's a certain moment when you realize that you've actually just left the planet for a bit, and that nobody can touch you. Don't matter. They can't even bust you. Not that you're thinking about getting busted, but you're elevated. Because you're with a bunch of guys that want to do the same thing as you. And when it works, baby, you've got wings. And you know you've been somewhere most people will never get. You've been to a special place, and then you want to keep going back and keep landing again. And when you land, you get busted. But you always want to go back there. It's flying without a license. Chapter 4. Mick, Brian, and me in Edith Grove, summer of 62. Learning Chicago blues, Marquee, Ealing Club, Crawdaddy Club, turf fights with the trad jazzers, Bill Wyman comes with his Vox. Wong in the Pog at the Station Hotel. We get Charlie on board. Andrew Lou Goldham signs us with Decca. First UK tour with the Everly Brothers, Bo Diddley, and Little Richard. Our music drowned in riots. The Beatles give us one. Andrew locks Mick and me in a kitchen, and we write our first song. The Rolling Stones spent the first year of their life hanging places, stealing food, and rehearsing. We were paying to be the Rolling Stones. The place where we lived, Mick, Brian, and I, at 102 Edith Grove in Fulham, was truly disgusting. We almost made it our professional business for it to be so, since we had little means to make it otherwise. We moved in the summer of 1962 and lived there for a year, through the coldest winter since 1740, as records attested. And the shillings we fed into the meter for warmth, for electricity and gas, were not that easy to come by. It was mattresses and no furniture to speak of, only a threadbare carpet. There was no fixed rotation between the two beds and a couple of mattresses, and it really didn't matter much. Usually all three of us would wake up on that floor, where we had the enormous radiogram that Brian had brought with him, a great 50s warm-up number. We'd sit around working out the music in the Weatherby Arms, in the King's Road, Chelsea. Usually I'd go round the rear and steal their empties, and then sell them back to them. You got a couple of pence on a beer bottle, which in those times was a lot of money. We stole empties at the parties we went to as well. Get one of us in first, and then the rest would come in gang formation. Edith Grove was a funny household. Three chicks underneath on the ground floor, student teachers from Sheffield, two poofters from Buxton above us. We had the middle floor. What the hell were we doing in Chelsea living between these northerners? It was a real slice of welcome to London, since nobody came from there. The student teachers from Sheffield are probably headmistresses now, but at the time, they were a randy bunch, which we had very little time for. We were in and out like Flynn. Mick and Brian were down there, but I never got involved with them. I didn't fancy them. But I found they came in handy. They would do a bit of laundry for you. Or my mum would send the washing via Bill from her washing machine demonstrations. The two incipient poofters hung out in the pubs in Earl's Court with the Australian poofters, of which there were many at that time. Earl's Court was Australia, basically. And a lot of them were wang-danglers because they could be more poofter in London than they could in Melbourne or Sydney or Brisbane. The guys above us would be talking with an Australian accent when they came back from these Earl's Court outings. They're going, "Hey, Cobba. I thought you were from Buxton." Our flatmate was called James Felge, the origin of half of the early pen name for our songwriting, Nanker Felge. A nanker is a look. The face stretched to horrible contortions by the fingers inserted into all available orifices. A great Brian specialty. We advertised for a flatmate over the mic at the Ealing Club. Someone to share the rent. Felge must have sensed what he was getting into. He turned out to be perhaps the only person on the planet who could have lived in that terrible place with us. And even outflank us in gross and unacceptable behavior. He was, in any case, apparently, the only one willing to live with this bunch pounding through the night, learning their crap, trying to find a gig. We were just idiotic together. We were still teenagers at the time, although at the top end of the scale. We dared each other. Who could be more disgusting than anybody else? You think you can disgust me? I'll show you. We'd get back from a gig, and Felge would be standing at the top of the stairs saying, "Welcome home," stark naked with his shitty underpants on his head, or pissing on you. Or flobbing at you. Felge was a serious flobber. Mucus from every area he could summon up. He loved to walk into a room with a huge snot hanging out of his nose and dribbling down his chin, but otherwise be perfectly charming. "Hello, how are you? And this is Andrea, and this is Jennifer." We had names for all different kinds of flob. Green Gilberts, Scarlet Jenkins. There was the Gabardine Helmsman, which is the one that people aren't aware of. They snot it, and it hangs on their lapel like a medal. That was the winner. Yellow Humphrey was another. The Flying V was the one that missed the handkerchief. People were always having colds in those days. Things were always running out of their noses, and they didn't know what to do with them. And it can't have been cocaine. It was a little too early. I think it was just bad English winters. Because we had nothing much to do, we had very few gigs, we ended up studying people. And we'd always be nicking things from the other flats. Go down and rifle the girls' drawers while they were out. Find a shilling or two. The bog was rigged up for recording. We'd just switch on if somebody went in there. Especially if one of the chicks downstairs said, "Can I use your John?" Because theirs was occupied. "Yes, sure." "Quick, turn it on." And then, after every performance, when the chain was pulled, it sounded like incredible applause. We'd play it back later. After every visit there, it sounded like Sunday night at the London Palladium. The worst horror, certainly for any visitors to Edith Grove, was the pile of unwashed dishes in the kitchen. The substances growing out of the crockery, the greasy cold pans piled in junked pyramids of foulness that no one could bear to touch. Yet it is true that one day we looked at this mess, Felge and I, and thought that there was perhaps nothing else to do than to clean it. Given that Felge was one of the filthiest people in the world, that was some historic decision. But that day, we were overwhelmed by the amount of rubbish, and so we went downstairs and stole a bottle of washing up liquid. At the time, the poverty seemed constant, unmovable. To go through that winter of 62 was rough. It was a cold winter. But then Brian had this fantastic idea of bringing up his friend Dick, who had his territorial army bonus, and Brian was merciless towards Dick. We didn't mind because we were getting the fallout. This is when nobody's got two pennies to rub to fucking gather. Dick is from Tewksbury, and Brian almost killed the man. He would force him to walk behind him and pay for everything. Cruel, cruel, cruel. He would make him stand outside while we ate, and he paid. Even Mick and I were shocked, and we were pretty cold-blooded. Sometimes he'd let him in for dessert. There was a streak of real cruelty in Brian. Dick was Brian's old school friend, and he was panting like a puppy after Brian. Once Brian left the poor sod outside with no clothes on, and it's snowing, and he's begging, and Brian's laughing. And I'm not going to go to the window. I'm laughing too much. How could a guy let himself get into that position? Brian stole all his clothes and then sent him outside in his underpants, in a snowstorm. What do you mean I owe you 23 pounds? Fuck off. He's just paid for us all evening. We've been feasting like kings. Terrible, really. Terrible. I said, Brian, that's just cold-blooded, man. Brian, a cold-blooded, vicious motherfucker. Only short and blonde with it. I wonder what happened to him. If he survived that, he could survive anything. We were cynical, sarcastic, and rude where necessary. We used to go to the local caf, which we called the Ernie, because everyone in there was named Ernie, or so it seemed. Ernie became everybody else. What a fucking Ernie, Christ. Anybody that insisted on doing his job without doing you a favor was a fucking Ernie. Ernie was the working man. Only got one thing on his mind. Making another extra shilling. If I'd had the choice of finding one diary of any 3-month period of the Stones' history, it would have been this one. The moment the band was hatching. And I did find one. Covering January to March of 1963. The real surprise was that I kept any record of this period. It covers the crucial span when Bill Wyman arrived, or more important, his Vox amplifier appeared, and Bill came with it. And when we were trying to snare, to coin a phrase, Charlie Watts. I even kept accounts of the money we earned at gigs, the pounds, shillings, and pence. Often, it just said zero when we played for beer at tiny end-of-term school dances. But entries also show January 21st, Ealing Club, zero. January 22nd, Flamingo, zero. February 1st, Red Lion, £1.10. At least we'd got a gig. As long as you've got a gig, life is wonderful. Somebody called us up and booked us. I mean, wow. We must be doing something right. Otherwise, shoplifting, picking up beer bottles, and hunger was the order of the day. We used to pool our money for guitar strings, mending amplifiers, and valves. Just to keep what we had going was an incredible expense. Inside the cover of the pocket diary are the heavily inked words, Chuck, Reed, Diddley. There you have it. That was all we listened to at the time. Just American blues or rhythm and blues or country blues. Every waking hour of every day was just sitting in front of the speakers trying to figure out how these blues were made. You collapsed on the floor with a guitar in your hands. That was it. You never stopped learning an instrument, but at the time, it was still very much searching about. You had to make sounds if you wanted to play a guitar. We went for a Chicago blues sound, as close as we could get it. 2 guitars, bass and drums, and a piano. And sat around and listened to every Chess record ever made. Chicago blues hit us right between the eyes. We'd all grown up with everything else that everybody had grown up with, rock and roll. But we focused on that. And as long as we were all together, we could pretend to be black men. We soaked up the music, but it didn't change the color of our skin. Some even went whiter. Brian Jones was a blonde Elmore James from Cheltenham. And why not? You can come from anywhere and be any color. We found that out later. Cheltenham, admittedly, is a bit far-fetched. Blues players from Cheltenham? There ain't a lot. And we didn't want to make money. We despised money. We despised cleanliness. We just wanted to be black motherfuckers. Fortunately, we got plucked out of that. But that was the school, That's where the band was born. The early days of the magic art of guitar weaving started then. You realize what you can do playing guitar with another guy, and what the two of you can do is to the power of 10, and then you add other people. There's something beautifully friendly and elevating about a bunch of guys playing music together. This wonderful little world that is unassailable. It's really teamwork, one guy supporting the others, and it's all for one purpose. And there's no flies in the ointment for a while. And nobody conducting. It's all up to you. It's really jazz. That's the big secret. Rock and roll ain't nothing but jazz, the hard backbeat. Jimmy Reed was a very big model for us. That was always two guitar stuff. Almost a study in monotony in many ways, unless you got in there. But then Jimmy Reed had 25 number one hits, with basically the same song. He had two tempos. But he understood the magic of repetition, of monotony, transforming itself to become this sort of hypnotic, trance-like thing. We were fascinated by it, Brian and I. We would spend every spare moment trying to get down Jimmy Reed's guitar sounds. Jimmy Reed was always pissed out of his brain. There was one famous time. He was already like an hour and 45 minutes late for his show. Finally, they get him onto the stage and he goes, "This one's called Baby What You Want Me to Do." And he threw up all over the first two rows. Probably happened many times. He always had his wife with him, whispering the lyrics in his ear. You could even hear it on the record sometimes. Going up, going down. But it worked. He was a solid favorite to the black folks in the South, and occasionally in the whole world. It was a fascinating study in restraint. Minimalism has a certain charm. You say that's a bit monotonous, but by the time it's finished, you're wishing it hadn't. There's nothing bad about monotony. Everyone's got to live with it. Great titles. Take out some insurance. This is not your everyday song title. And it would always come down to him and his old lady having a fight or something. Bright Lights, Big City, Baby What You Want Me to Do, String to Your Heart, wicked songs. One of Jimmy's lines was, "Don't take no subway, I'd rather see you pull a train," which actually means, don't go on the dope, don't go underground. I'd rather see you either drunk or on cocaine. Took me years and years to decipher this. And I was heavily into Muddy Waters guitarist Jimmy Rogers and the guys that played behind Little Walter, the Myers brothers. Talk about an ancient form of weaving. They were the masters. Half of the band was the Muddy Waters band, which included Little Walter as well. But while he was making these records, he had another little team, Lewis Myers and his brother David, founders of the Aces, two great guitar players. Pat Hare used to play with Muddy Waters, and also did a few tracks with Chuck Berry. One of his unreleased numbers was called "I'm Gonna Murder My Baby," dug up from the Sun vaults after he did just that, and then killed the policeman sent to investigate. He went in for life in the early 60s, and died in a Minnesota jail. It was Matt Murphy and Hubert Sumlin. They were all Chicago blues players, some more solo than others. But his teams, if we keep it down to that, the Myers brothers definitely go way up to the top of the list. Jimmy Rogers with Muddy Waters, an amazing pair of weavers. Chuck Berry's fantastic, but he would weave by himself, with himself. He did great overdubs with his own guitar, because he was too cheap to hire another guy most of the time. But that's just on records. You can't recreate that live. But his Memphis, Tennessee is probably one of the most incredible little bits of overdubbing and tinkering that I've ever heard, let alone a sweet song. I could never overstress how important he was in my development. It still fascinates me how this one guy could come up with so many songs and sling it so gracefully and elegantly. So we sat there in the cold, dissecting tracks for as long as the meter held out. A new Bo Diddley record goes under the surgical knife. "Have you got that wah-wah? What were the drums playing? How hard were they playing? What were the maracas doing?" You had to take it all apart and put it back together again, from your point of view. "We need a reverb. Now we're really in the shit. We need an amplifier. Bo Diddley was high-tech. Jimmy Reed was easier. He was straightforward. But to dissect how he played, Jesus. It took me years to find out how he actually played the 5 chord in the key of E, the B chord, the last of the 3 chords before you go home, the resolver in a 12-bar blues, the dominant chord, as it's called. When he gets to it, Jimmy Reed produces a haunting refrain, a melancholy dissonance. Even for non-guitar players, it's worth trying to describe what he does. At the 5 chord, instead of making the conventional bar chord, the B7th, which requires a little effort with the left hand, he wouldn't bother with the B at all. He'd leave the open A note ringing, and just slide the finger up the D string to a 7th. And there's the haunting note, resonating against the open A. So you're not using root notes, but letting it fall against the 7th. Believe me, it's A, the laziest, sloppiest single thing you can do in that situation, and B, one of the most brilliant musical inventions of all time. But that is how Jimmy Reed managed to play the same song for 30 years and get away with it. I learned how to do it from a white boy, Bobby Goldsboro, who had a couple of hits in the 60s. He used to work with Jimmy Reed, and he said he'd show me the tricks. I knew all the other moves, but I never knew that 5-chord move until he showed it to me, on a bus somewhere in Ohio in the mid-60s. He said, I spent years on the road with Jimmy Reed. He does that 5-chord like this. Shit, that's all it is? That's it, motherfucker. You live and learn. Suddenly, out of a bright sky, you get it. That haunting, droning note. Absolute disregard for any musical rules whatsoever. Also, absolute disregard for the audience or anybody else. It goes like this. In a way, we admired Jimmy more for that than his playing. It was the attitude. And also very haunting songs. They might be based on the seemingly simplistic bedrock, but you try Little Rain. One of the first lessons I learned with guitar playing was that none of these guys were actually playing straight chords. There's a throw-in, a flick-back. Nothing's ever a straight major. It's an amalgamation, a mangling and a dangling and a tangling thing. There is no properly. There's just how you feel about it. Feel your way around it. It's a dirty world down here. Mostly I've found playing instruments that I actually want to be playing something that should be played by another instrument. I find myself trying to play horn lines all the time on the guitar. When I was learning how to do these songs, I learned there is often one note doing something that makes the whole thing work. It's usually a suspended chord. It's not a full chord. It's a mixture of chords, which I love to use to this day. If you're playing a straight chord, whatever comes next should have something else in it. If it's an A chord, a hint of D. Or if it's a song with a different feeling, if it's an A chord, a hint of G should come in somewhere, which makes a 7th, which then can lead you on. Readers who wish to can skip Keefe's guitar workshop, but I'm passing on the simple secrets anyway, which led to the open chord riffs of later years, the Jack Flash and Gimme Shelter ones. There's some people looking to play guitar. There's other people looking for a sound. I was looking for a sound when Brian and I were rehearsing in Edith Grove. Something easily done by 3 or 4 guys, and you wouldn't be missing any instruments or sound on it. You had a wall of it in your face. I just followed the bosses. A lot of those blues players of the mid-50s, Albert King and B.B. King, were single-note players. T-Bone Walker was one of the first to use the double-string thing, to use 2 strings instead of 1. And Chuck got a lot out of T-Bone. Musically impossible, but it works. The notes clash, they jangle. You're pulling 2 strings at once, and you're putting them in a position where actually their knickers are pulled up. You've always got something ringing against the note or the harmony. Chuck Berry is all double string stuff. He very rarely plays single notes. The reason the cat started to play like that, T-Bone and so on, was economics. to eliminate the need for a horn section. With an amplified electric guitar, you could play two harmony notes, and you could basically save money on two saxophones and a trumpet. And my double string playing was why, in the very first Sid Cup days, I was looked on as a bit of a wild rock and roller, and not really a serious blues player. Everybody else was playing away on single strings. It worked for me because I was playing a lot by myself, so two strings were better than one. And it had the possibility of getting this dissonance and this rhythm thing going, which you can't do picking away on one string. It's finding the moves. Chords are something to look for. There's always the lost chord. Nobody's found it. Brian and I, we had the Jimmy Reed stuff down. When we were really hunkering down and working, Mick obviously felt a little bit out of it. Also, he was away at the London School of Economics for much of the day to start with. He couldn't play anything. That's why he picked up on the harp and the maracas. Brian had picked up on the harmonica very quickly at first, and I think Mick didn't want to be left behind. I wouldn't be surprised if from the beginning, it wasn't just from being in competition with Brian. He wanted to play in the band musically as well, and Mick turned out to be the most amazing harp player. I'd put him up there with the best in the world on a good night. Everything else we know he can do. He's a great showman, but to a musician, Mick Jagger is a great harp player. His phrasing is incredible. It's very Louis Armstrong, Little Walter, and that's saying something. Little Walter Jacobs was one of the best singers of the blues, and a blues harp player par excellence. I find it hard to listen to him without awe. His band, the Jukes, were so hip and sympathetic. His singing was overshadowed by the phenomenal harp, which was based on a lot of Louis Armstrong's cornet licks. Little Walter would smile in his grave for the way Mick plays. Mick and Brian played totally different styles. Mick sucking like Little Walter, Brian blowing like Jimmy Reed, both bending notes. When you play like that, the Jimmy Reed style, it's called High and Lonesome, and when you hear it, it just touches the heart. Mick is one of the best natural blues harp players I've ever heard. His harp playing is the one place where you don't hear any calculation. I say, why don't you sing like that? He says they're totally different things, but they're not. They're both blowing air out of your gob. This band was very fragile. No one was looking for this thing to fly. I mean, we're anti-pop, we're anti-ballroom. All we want to do is be the best blues band in London and show the fuckers what's what, because we know we can do it. And these weird little bunches of people would come in and support us. We didn't even know where they came from or why, or how they found out where we were. We didn't think we were ever going to do anything much except turn other people onto Muddy Waters and Bo Diddley and Jimmy Reed. We had no intention of being anything ourselves. The idea of making a record seemed to be totally out of the picture. Our job at that time was idealistic. We were unpaid promoters for Chicago Blues. It was terribly Shining Shields and everything like that, and monastic intense study, for me at least. Everything from when you woke up to when you went to sleep was dedicated to learning, listening, and trying to find some money, a division of labor. The ideal thing was, right, we've got enough to live on, a few bob in case of emergencies, and on top of that, beautiful. These girls come around, three or four of them, Lee Muhammad and her mates, and clear up for us, cook for us, and just hang about. What the hell they saw in us at the time, I don't know. We didn't have any other interest in the world except how to keep the electricity going and how to nick a few things out of the supermarket for food. Women were really third on that list. Electricity, food, and then hey, you got lucky. We needed to work together. We needed to rehearse. We needed to listen to music. We needed to do what we wanted to do. It was a mania. Benedictines had nothing on us. Anybody that strayed from the nest to get laid, or to try to get laid, was a traitor. You were supposed to spend all your waking hours studying Jimmy Reed, Muddy Waters, Little Walter, Howlin' Wolf, Robert Johnson. That was your gig. Every other moment taken away from it was a sin. It was that kind of atmosphere, that kind of attitude that we lived with. The women around were really quite peripheral. The drive in the band was amazing among Mick, Brian, and myself. It was incessant study. Not really in the academic sense of it. It was to get the feel of it. And then, I think we realized, like any young guys, that blues are not learned in a monastery. You've got to go out there and get your heart broke and then come back. And then you can sing the blues. Preferably several times. At that time, we were taking it on a purely musical level, forgetting that these guys were singing about shit. First you've got to get in the shit, and then you can maybe come back and sing it. I thought I loved my mother, and I left her. She still did my laundry. And I got my heart broken, but not right away. My sights were still set on Lee Muhammad. The venues in the diary are the Flamingo Club in Wardour Street, where Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated played, the Ealing Club, mentioned already. Richmond was the Crawdaddy Club in the Station Hotel, where we really took off. The Marquee was then in Oxford Street, where Cyril Davies' R&B All-Stars performed after he'd broken away from Corner. The Red Lion was in Sutton, South London. And the Manor House was a pub in North London. The sums of money were the paltry earnings from playing our guts out. But they began to get better. I don't think the Stones would have actually coagulated without Ian Stewart pulling it together. He was the one that rented the first rehearsal rooms, told people to get there at a certain time. Otherwise, it was so nebulous. We didn't know shit from Shinola. It was his vision, the band, and basically, he picked who was going to be in it. Far more than anybody actually realizes, he was the spark and the energy and the organization that actually kept it together in its early days, because there wasn't much money. But there was this idealistic hope that we can bring the blues to England. We have been chosen. All that dopey sort of stuff. And Stu had such incredible enthusiasm in that way. He'd stepped out, made a split with the people he played with. He took a leap in the dark there, really. It was against the grain. It alienated him from his cozy little club scene. Without Stu, we'd have been lost. He'd been around the club scene a lot longer. We were just new kids on the block. One of his first strategies was to wage guerrilla war against the trad jazzers. That was a big, bitter cultural shift. The traditional jazz bands, aka Dixieland bands, semi-beatniks, were doing very, very well. Midnight in Moscow, Acker Bilk, the whole goddamn lot of them. They flooded the market. Very good players. Chris Barber and all of those cats. They ran the scene. But they couldn't understand that things were moving and that they should incorporate something else into their music. How could we dislodge the Dixieland Mafia? There seemed to be no chinks in their armor. It was Stu's idea that we play the interval at the Marquee while Acker was having a beer. No money in it, but the interval was the thin end of the wedge. Stu figured out that strategy. He would just turn up and say, no money, but interval at the Marquee or the Manor House. Suddenly, the interval became more interesting than the main event. You put the interval band on, and they're playing Jimmy Reed, 15 minutes, and it was really only a matter of months before the traditional jazz monopoly faded away. There was bitter hatred of us. I don't like your music. Why don't you play in ballrooms? You go, we're staying. But we had no idea that the ground was shifting at the time. We weren't that arrogant. We were just happy to get a gig. There is a parable on film of the changeover of power between jazz and rock and roll, in Jazz on a Summer's Day, a hugely important film for aspiring rock musicians at the time, mostly because it featured Chuck Berry at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1958. Playing Sweet Little 16. The film had Jimmy Giuffre, Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk. But Mick and I went to see the man, that black coat. He was brought on the stage, a very bold move by someone, with Joe Jones on drums, a jazz great. Joe Jones was, among others, Count Basie's drummer. I think it was Chuck's proudest moment when he got up there. It's not a particularly good version of Sweet Little 16, but it was the attitude of the cats behind him, solid against the way he looked, the way he was moving. They were laughing at him. They were trying to fuck him up. Joe Jones was raising his drumstick after every few beats and grinning as if he were in play school. Chuck knew he was working against the odds. And he wasn't really doing very well when you listened to it, but he carried it. He had a band behind him that wanted to toss him, but he still carried the day. Joe Jones blew it right there. Instead of a knife in the back, he could have given him the shit, but Chuck forced his way through. A description of the early days of bookings and of my amazement and excitement that we were starting to be a working band comes in another letter to my Aunt Patty, Astonishing to Find, which came to light while I was writing this book. Wednesday, 19th December. Keith Richards, 6 Spielman Road, Dartford. Dear Patty, thanks for the birthday card. Arrived on the correct day, 18th, full marks. Hope you are both keeping well and all that chiz-chiz. I'm having a ball here. I live in my friend's flat in Chelsea most of the time. We are starting to make the music business quite profitable. The next big craze over here is for rhythm and blues, and we are in demand. This week, we have clinched a deal to play regularly at the Flamingo Nightclub in Wardour Street, starting next month. We were talking to an agent on Monday who reckons that we have a very commercial sound, and if all goes well, and he isn't another twister, we could be earning 60 to 70 pounds a week shortly. Also, there is a record company starting to send us letters as regards a session in the next few months. Straight up the Hot 100. Still, enough of my antics. Everyone here is back to recovery, except that my leprosy keeps coming back, and Dad's got Parkinson's disease, and Mum's down with a sleeping sickness. Can't think of much more, so we'll sign off now. Have a lovely Xmas. Love from Keith, X. This is the first sighting of my nickname, Keefe, and it shows it didn't come originally from fans. I was known as Cousin Beef in my extended family, and that turned naturally to Keefe. The short time covered by the diary ends at the exact moment when our future was assured, our getting a regular gig at the Crawdaddy Club in Richmond, from which everything sprinkled out. Fame in 6 weeks. To me, Charlie Watts was the secret essence of the whole thing. And that went back to Ian Stewart. We have to have Charlie Watts. And all the skullduggery that went down in order to get Charlie. We starved ourselves to pay for him. Literally. We went shoplifting to get Charlie Watts. We cut down on our rations. We wanted him so bad, man. And now, we're stuck with him. At first, we had neither Bill nor Charlie, though Bill is mentioned in the second diary entry. January 1963, Wednesday the 2nd. New bass guitarist with Tony trying out. One of the best rehearsals ever. Bass guitar adds more power to sounds. Also secured with bass guitarist is one 100 GNS Vox amplifier. Decided on program for Marquee. Must be a knockout to secure a bigger spot. Bill had amplifiers. Bill came fully equipped. He was a package deal. We used to play with this guy called Tony Chapman, who was merely a fill-in. And I don't know if it was Stu or Tony, much to his own detriment, who said, "Oh, I've got this other player," which was Bill. And Bill arrived with his amplifier, believe it or not, protected by Meccano, with the green stuff on the screws. A Vox AC-30 amplifier, which was beyond our means to possess. Built by Jennings in Dartford, we used to worship it. We used to look at it and get on our knees. To have an amplifier was crucial. First off, I just wanted to separate Bill from his amplifier, but that was before he started playing with Charlie. Thursday the 3rd, Marquee with Cyril. 1 or 2.5 hour sets, 10 pounds to 12 pounds. Very good set. Bo Diddley received with very good applause. 612 people attended session. First set, good warm-up. Second set swung, fabulously. Impressed some very big people. Received 2 pounds, Paul Pond. Knockout. Harold Pendleton asked to be introduced. He was the owner of the Marquee. I tried to kill the guy twice by swinging my guitar at his head. He hated rock and roll and was always sneering. Friday 4. Flamingo ad. Original Chicago R&B sound starring the Rolling Stones. And we'd never been north of bloody Watford. Play Red Lion, Sutton. Pickup came unsoldered. Red Lion. Band played poorly. Nevertheless, a raving reception. Especially Bo Diddley and Sweet Little 16. Tony Diabolical. Discussed presentation for Flamingo. Good quote in MM, Melody Maker. Came up in the afternoon. Lost wallet. 30 in it. Should be retrieved. And a first hint of a recording of any sort. Saturday 5. Got wallet back. Richmond. Cock up. My pickup clapped out completely. Brian played harp and I used his guitar. Confessing the Blues, Diddley Daddy, Jerome, and Bo Diddley went well. Mad row with promoter over money. Refused to play there again. Discussed new demo disc. To be made this week with any luck. Diddley Daddley looked good. With Cleo and Friends as vocal group. Band earned 37 pounds this week. 37 pounds for 5 blokes. Monday 7th, Flamingo. Must hone Stu, Tony, and Gorgonzola. My guitar returned in perfect working order. Flamingo on first thought, not too hot. But Johnny Gunnell, more than satisfied. Tony must go. That means Bill and Vox. Confessing the Blues went well. Lee came down. I've got my brand. In which I seem to assume the mantle of musical director. Johnny Gunnell. It was the Gunnell brothers, Johnny and Ricky, who ran the Flamingo. And Bill and his Vox are secured. A historic day. The last line is from Muddy Waters. I got my brand on you. I was definitely hot on Lee. Tuesday 8. 30 pound 10. Ealing. Band played quite well. Bo Diddley was an absolute knockout. If we can repeat this performance at the Marquee, we'll be laughing. Started Ealing on Saturday. Look what you've done. Reasonable. Thursday 10. 12 pounds. Tony Meehan reckoned the band. He was the drummer with the Shadows. Marquee. First set, 8:30 or 9 o'clock, musically very good, but didn't quite click. Second set, 9:45 to 10:15, swung much better. Brian and I rather put off by lack of volume due to work to rule in power station. Bo Diddley, tremendous applause as usual. Lee and the girls came down. Approached Charlie for regular work. Halfway through the set and suddenly the power went down. We were fucked. We were rocking. And then they put us to half power, due to an industrial action by the electricity workers. And we're looking at one another. We're looking at our amplifiers. We're looking at the sky, the ceiling. Friday 11. Bill agrees to stay on, even if we chuck Tony. Monday 14. Tony sacked. Flamingo. Surprise. Rick and Carlo played. Without a doubt,